Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
It goes back to like before I was ready to get a divorce. It's been like 10 or more years. Waking up like several times a night and not being able to get back to sleep.
That's Mitch, a sleep cocktail customer in Santa Cruz, California.
I get 2 hours of good sleep. And then after that, my eyes would open and toss and turn, and the rest of the night was really not restful at all.
Then Mitch found out about Sleep Cocktail and started sleeping through the night, every night.
So nice to be getting rest again after, you know, all those years of not. And even if I do wake up in the middle of the night, I'm able to get back to sleep.
Do you have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep? Try Doc Parsley's Sleep Cocktail. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.
Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Super excited for today's guest. Dennis McKenna is an American ethnopharmacologist. He is the author of The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, and is just a fascinating character whose work is held in extremely high regard in my world. Dennis, how are you doing?
Doing well, Rob. Thanks for asking me on to your show.
Huge honor to have you here. So Dennis, what is an ethnopharmacologist?
Okay, well, an ethnopharmacologist, there's the thumbnail definition and the formal definition. I guess the thumbnail definition is the study of medicines, not only medicines, but any biologically active substances from nature that are used by indigenous cultures, usually in a traditional context. That would be the short definition. Since we only have an hour, I won't go into the long definition, but that pretty well sums it up. It's interdisciplinary investigation of those things. And as you know, indigenous people are quite ingenious about identifying useful plants in their environment, useful other sources of these things too. It's not confined to plants as medicines, as poisons. I mean, for instance, the study of arrow poison would be a legitimate study for ethnopharmacology, but usually the focus is on medicines, you know.
And Dennis, could you give us some examples of what some of the maybe both more popularly known and perhaps less well known, both the plant sources and the biologically active substances are that you talk about and have studied?
Well, most of my work has been devoted to the study of psychedelic plants and or fungi, which have an important role in indigenous cultures. My academic work and lately my personal work too, or really for a long time, has been more or less focused on ayahuasca, which is, many of your readers will know about this, it's becoming popular. It's getting a lot of attention. As a matter of fact, there was an article just this week in the New Yorker about ayahuasca where I was interviewed. I can send you a link to that if you want.
I read it. It's very, very okay. Actually well done. Yeah, we will put that in the
fairly
show notes
well
for sure.
Done. I was disappointed with some parts of it. But
yeah.
I came off sounding pretty good in the article. And yeah, and ayahuasca is, it's kind of at the center of traditional medical practices, ethnomedicine and shamanism in South America. And it's a complex preparation. It's made from at least two plants, which have a synergistic effect. One contains the hallucinogen, the psychedelic compound DMT. Dimethyltryptamine, but DMT by itself is not orally active. So it requires, or when combined with the bark of the other main ingredient in ayahuasca, Banisteriopsis caapi, a big jungle liana, woody vine, that contains alkaloids that inhibit monoamine oxidase, the enzyme in the gut that breaks down DMT. So it's protected from degradation in the gut, and it manages to make it to the brain in an intact form. So instead of when you take DMT other than by mouth, or by smoking it or snuffing it, for example, it has a very rapid, very intense psychedelic effect that only lasts maybe 20 minutes. If you take it orally, as in ayahuasca, it lasts 6 or 7 hours. Mm. So it's less intense, but you get more out of it. You know, there's more content in a certain way when you take it orally. And that's the basis of ayahuasca. And many people are interested in this, you know, going to South America to find their shaman to sample this, or you can find it in the States too now. Ayahuasqueros, as they're called, these specialists come up to the States and go on like rock star style tours and that kind of thing. And there are various places in the States where it is used, but those are kind of underground. I mean, technically, ayahuasca is illegal because of the controlled substance in it, DMT. The other plant's not illegal. But there are two religions, Brazilian religions, that also use it as a sacrament, and they are allowed to do this in the States because they've taken their case all the way to the Supreme Court. And, you know, the Supreme Court has granted them an exemption because what they do is a religious practice. So under Religious Freedom Restoration Act, they are permitted to use ayahuasca. Technically, nobody else is permitted legally to do that. But I don't see that's slowing people down. It's right. You know, they tell me in New York on any typical weekend, there's more than 100 ayahuasca ceremonies happening around the city. That's Dennis, possibly not a good thing. But
right, depending on the circumstance. Yeah. You know, psychedelics have always been pretty fascinating to me in that, you know, from a, guess kind of a pharmacological perspective, an addiction and abuse perspective, they're pretty low, let's say, relative to like opiates or even alcohol. Could you talk about that a little bit, like the tachyphylaxis, the adaptation that occurs rather rapidly with everything from mescaline to psilocybin to DMT? Like, why?
Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah, well, the psychedelics as a class do not cause addiction. They don't work on those systems. They don't work on the opiate system or the dopamine, you know, reinforcing pathways. They work on different pathways, serotonin, and you don't get that reinforcing effect. In fact, psychedelics, if anything, are anti-addictive. They have been used to treat addiction with quite a lot of success, and they're actually not, you know, you can treat alcoholism, even smoking. There have been some very impressive studies that have come recently out of Johns Hopkins using psilocybin to treat smoking cessation with absolutely spectacular results compared to any other treatment that's out there. So these things can be used to treat addiction to other substances. And as far as the psychedelics themselves, they're anything but addictive. I mean, in the first place, you develop a tolerance very rapidly. And in the second place, they usually kind of move you off your dime. They move you out of your comfort zone temporarily. And it takes a bit of courage to... It takes the courage to take them in the first place, and it takes courage to go back and repeat that experience. Many people, you know, they have no particular impulse to go right back into it and repeat it. Eventually, many people do. But so psychedelics themselves are not addicting, and they can be used to treat addiction. On other parameters, are they harmful? Long-term use and so on, they don't appear to be. You know, like everything can be overdone, you know, and there's wisdom in the rule of thumb, moderation in all things. But occasional use of psychedelics is probably good for mental health. And there are actually studies that show that people who are occasional users of psilocybin mushrooms, for example, have generally more positive attitudes, less incidences of depression, and it's just kind of a tonic for mental health. So there's, you know, that what we used to believe about psychedelics was mostly propaganda, you know, the idea that these things are going to drive you crazy and all that. If you have schizophrenia, if you have a proclivity to mental illness, you probably shouldn't take these things. And in any case, you should always pay it. You know, you should do it from an informed place. You have to pay attention to set and setting, right? The circumstances that you do them under and the mindset that you bring to it, what you bring to the table, what are your expectations. So the more you can inform yourself before you take any psychedelic and the more you can pay attention to the circumstances, the proper set and setting, the better experience, the more positive it's going to be for you. So just a little bit of thoughtfulness about how and where and you take them.
Right.
You know, and the other variable, of course, is dose and purity. So know what you're taking. And that's one reason why I say if you're going to take a psychedelic, stick with the plants. You know, take a plant preparation. Mushrooms, you know what that is. Ayahuasca, usually, you know what that is. You know, pills could be anything. You know, and there is such a proliferation of designer drugs now, some of which, you know, are probably harmless, but some of which may not be so harmless. So I tend to, and there's no sure way to know, you know, what those things are. So in the world of ecstasy and Molly and all that, there, which is, you know, there's such a proliferation of different kinds, there's just no quality control happening.
Right,
so
right.
That's where one should be cautious.
Yeah, I guess like some of the recent celebrity deaths, like Prince and fentanyl, thinking mm-hmm. that he was getting something like a Percocet, but the fentanyl, I didn't even realize the pharmacology on it. Like about the equivalent of 3 grains of sand is enough to cause, you know, suppressed breathing and coma and death. I mean, that's a pretty narrow window of you know, mistake that you can make on that. And if you think that you're getting one thing and getting something else, and clearly that could be disastrous.
Yeah, that's right. And that's where much of this hazard of these things comes up. And Prince was under the care of a physician, you know. I mean, apparently he was. I can't say that for sure, but I think that he was. Fentanyl's a prescription drug. It's a very potent narcotic. It's many more times more powerful than heroin. But it's very short acting, right? They use it almost like an anesthetic. Extremely short acting, but very potent. And now I've read recently there's something else on the market called kerfentanil that is coming out of China that is like 100,000 times more potent than heroin.
Right.
Nothing that any sane person would want to take because there's no way to measure the dose. And this is a good example of, you know, what has happened to this designer drug market. You know, Chinese will make anything and, you know, they don't care. And then that stuff can be sold off websites and there's just, you know, absolutely no way to control that. So, you know, you have to rely on education to inform people that this stuff is out there and should no way be taken, you know. So the whole synthetic designer drug market has turned pretty dark,
right?
Basically,
right. Dennis, I know this stuff gets super political, but why in a reasonable world, would psychedelics that have a long history of traditional use and low addictive potential and whatnot, why would they be lumped in with things like cocaine and heroin and litigated against and attacked, you know, in a way that like they're depleted uranium or something like that? Like, I mean, it's a little crazy, and I'm possibly a little crazy anyway. And I think having, you know, a decent background in pharmacology and stuff, you're able to look at this stuff in a possibly more objective way than somebody that you know, like when my system admin guy tells me that the SQRT bundle is communicating with something, I'm just kind of like, okay, I've got to take it at face value so I can understand that, you know, different pharmaceuticals and bioactive substances could be a similar opaque, you know, kind of experience for people without that background. But why has it been so marginalized and assailed? We're just now starting to get some decent academic research on a lot of these substances. Like, where did this all come from?
Well, I think the key word here, Rob, is reasonable. You know, in a reasonable society, these things wouldn't have been banned in the first place. I think what you're looking at is the fallout from the 60s, basically. I think that in the 60s, you know, LSD kind of came along and it kind of dropped like a bomb into society. We had no context for this. We were not, as a society, we were not aware of the indigenous traditions of using these things. It was a time of social turmoil. LSD made people have funny ideas, like maybe I don't need to go to Vietnam and kill people, you know. And so the powers that be saw these as socially disruptive, and which they were, but, you know, in ways that we would probably say is a good way. You know, they enabled people to, you know, kind of think for themselves. But I think there was a knee-jerk reaction on the part of politicians, worried parents, authorities, everybody else that we kind of lump under the term the powers that be. It was a hysterical reaction. And, you know, it was way more than was warranted given the actual properties of these compounds. But, you know, everything was banned pretty much at one time at the end of the 60s in 1970, I think. It's taken 40 years to overcome that, to realize that, well, maybe that was an overreaction. And now, you know, with some of the emerging research, we're finding not only was it an overreaction, but we're overlooking these medicines, which have a great deal of potential for therapeutic use, for treating everything from PTSD to addictions, to intractable depression, to OCD, you know, a lot of things, including, interestingly enough, since you mentioned it, post-traumatic brain injury. Some of these compounds are neuroprotective, it turns out. DMT is one example. This is entirely sort of outside the context of the fact that it's a psychedelic. It's also neuroprotective. So, you know, it's taken that long for the hysteria to die down, for cooler heads to look at it and say, well, maybe we threw the baby out with the bathwater here. You know, because Schedule 1 classification, which also applies incredibly to cannabis, you know, and the DEA just continued its Schedule 1 classification for cannabis.
Right.
Schedule 1 says absolutely no medical application, high potential for abuse, dangerous, toxic, worthless in every respect. That clearly does not apply to the psychedelics, and it shouldn't apply to cannabis. This is what happens when politicians, instead of people with information like pharmacologists or doctors, you know, make these kinds of decisions. Politicians are generally ignorant about practically everything, you know. I mean, I love to bash politicians, right?
You're in warm company there. Yeah.
And so they know nothing. And not only do they know nothing, but they don't bother to educate themselves about them at all. So they are worried. Most politicians, unfortunately, seem to be worried about one thing only, and that's getting reelected. And unfortunately, their electorates are as ignorant as they are on these kind of science and medicine related issues, you know. Just a good example. I mean, well, I don't want to rave too much.
No, please rave. Please, please. We love raves on this show. Please.
Something just happened last week that was really, you know, quite disappointing to me, which is there is this drug out there called Kratom. You might have heard of it.
Yeah, yeah. An opiate modulator, yeah.
Yeah, it's a plant from Southeast Asia that is used kind of like opium. It definitely hits opiate receptors in the brain, but it does not cause respiratory depression, which is what kills people from opiates. And until a couple weeks ago, it was legal. You could buy it in head shops, and many people were using kratom or kratom extracts to get off the more addictive drugs, often OxyContin, and then they go from OxyContin to heroin. Kratom was actually part of the solution, I thought. Here is an herbal medicine, relatively non-toxic. People are using it successfully to discontinue their addictions to heroin. And so it was part of the solution, you know, non-toxic herb. But the DEA decided to make it Schedule 1. For no particular reason, very few deaths were associated with kratom, and most of those that were traced to people who were taking heroin and kratom at the same time. So kratom doesn't cause respiratory depression. It's non-toxic. So for that reason alone, it's a better alternative. But the DEA, again, apparently not talking to their scientists, because they certainly have scientists advising them, but on the administrative side, they just decided to make it Schedule 1. So that's unfortunate. It means that that option is not available to people where it might have been before. As a result, people are going to die who wouldn't have to die, you know, and I think that's unfortunate. This is a good example of how these sort of ill-thought-through administrative and political decisions really impact people's lives.
I think absolutely.
Yeah. So
the FDA just cracked down on e-cigarettes, which had been shown pretty conclusively to reduce tobacco consumption, depending on if the preparation within the e-cigarettes were relatively clean, then they, you know, there really wasn't much of a downside to that consumption. Nicotine as a pharmacological agent isn't really all that much to get concerned about. It's all delivery, you know, mechanisms via tobacco that are usually concerning. But they just took this thing that was easily accessible, clearly had shown significant benefit, and made the access almost impossible. And we continue to see more and more examples of things like that.
I guess you have to be over 18 or so. I missed that. I didn't realize that they had cracked down on e-cigarettes, but that's exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
You know, here's a thing that is relatively benign compared to what it's replacing. And why they would make that decision, I just have no idea. It's, you know, Rob, it's enough to make people believe in conspiracies.
Well, you know, it's funny. They just had a piece, Wall Street Journal. I mean, everybody has picked this up, that in the 60s, there's some documents now that the sugar industry basically paid off the government, you know, key governmental people, to really heavily malign any type of fat, particularly animal-based fat like butter, and to minimize any type of negative signaling around sugar and refined carbohydrates. And, I mean, this stuff is damning. I mean, it's like, holy smokes. And so we've reached a point where, you know, it's funny. I really like listening to a guy, Dan Carlin, great podcaster, great thinker. But he's made the point that there are so many real conspiracies mixed with so much disinformation that it's kind of a crapshoot.
it's very hard to sort it out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's very hard. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but sometimes you have to wonder. I tend to attribute a lot of these decisions, policy changes, and so on, not so much to conspiracy, as to just stupidity,
right,
and not really thinking it through,
right,
you know. But you know, one of the things, I read that article about the sugar industry and so on. One of the things that I think this has an effect that goes far beyond any one of these one things is it shows that science is corrupt. And, you know, science used to be one of the things that we could look up at to that had a kind of integrity about it. You know, scientists were seekers of truth. No, actually, it seems that they're shills of the nutritional industry, the pharmaceutical industry. You know, so the respectability of science comes into question. And, you know, I think that, you know, we should always be, you know, in a way, skeptical of science. I mean, that's kind of what science encourages. But when you read articles like this, you realize one of the last institutions that gets respect in our culture, even that's corrupt.
Right.
So what's left? Politics is corrupt. Religion is corrupt. It carries no moral authority. Science is corrupt. It carries no scientific authority. Who can you believe? You know, what can you believe in this culture?
Personal experience and outcomes, which is exactly what I try to really get people to hang their hat on. You know, if you've been messing around with a super high carb diet and you're dyslipidemic and starving all the time, maybe we go the opposite end of the spectrum and see how that works. And you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. If you're feeling good, your blood lipids look fantastic.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it. What can you believe? You can believe in yourself. And, you know, people, you know, say, I mean, before I was writing this, before I went on the show, I was replying to a young man who was writing me, telling me how, you know, my brother and I had brainwashed him, you know, and then the Hare Krishnas and then the political system. And I wrote back and say, nobody has an agenda to brainwash you. Try thinking for yourself for a change.
Mm.
You know, that's always been my message. Think for yourself. Don't believe me. Don't believe Terrence McKenna. Don't believe anybody. Look at the data and think for yourself. That's what, and people don't want to do that. You know, it's like they've got a brain, especially younger people, if they're confused, they don't know what to believe. Well, I'm not here to tell you what to believe. Work it out. Figure it out. You know, you've got to learn to trust yourself.
Right.
That's about the only thing you can trust in some context these days, you know. Yeah, unfortunate, too, because science, properly practiced, is a very powerful thing, you know. But it's not something that asks people to have faith in it,
right,
or anything. Yet we do. In fact, the scientific message is don't have faith, you know, don't have belief. Science is a way to ask questions of the world and get answers back that you can verify. But then when you see that whole segments of science are basically in the service of political interests, the whole edifice becomes shaky, because then it all becomes open to question, you know.
You know, it's funny because, you know, in this attempt to control the horizontal and the vertical, then when you have this one exception, and part of what I'm thinking here, you know, so mainstream medicine and the DEA would tell us that cannabinoid products have no medicinal quality. That's why they're Schedule 1. But then it's very easy to track down information, anecdotal for the most part, but also some, you know, decently performed randomized controlled trials showing that, like, cannabis in general, but cannabidiol oils are quite efficacious for a host of inflammatory conditions, for seizure disorders. And so then you get that one exception. So if science is telling us there's no benefit here, and then you find a benefit, then all of a sudden you start questioning everything. And I think some of this, you know, whether it's politics or even just well-meaning people, there are quacks out there. There are people who prey upon the desperation of people who are dealing with cancer or other intractable diseases. And so on the one hand, you do want to create, I guess, potentially some sort of a system of checks and balances, although I would argue that we need like 6 or 7 different entities, not just the FDA, but maybe 7 different FDAs that all compete against each other. And then we would actually get to the get to brass tacks really damn fast with all that stuff. But, I get what the sentiment is, that there needs to be somebody protecting somebody somewhere. But then at the same time, when the people protecting you are preventing the access of things that are known to be both safe and superiorly efficacious for a host of conditions that we have no other solutions for, then it not only is it frustrating on that side, but then I think it pushes people even further into the pseudoscience realm. Then if you question that one element of science, then you can just go off and do what a host of other kind of crazy directions.
Yeah, exactly. That's the danger. It will lead people to reject science altogether.
Right.
And that's unfortunate, because that encourages, you know, loose thinking. I mean, really delusional thinking in some ways. And it's not that science has all the answers, but science is in some ways a self-correcting thing. But these decisions to keep cannabis Schedule 1, it has nothing to do with medicine or science. They've totally ignored the much scientific evidence. While we were talking, I just went on PubMed, which is the National Library of Medicine biomedical database. I'm sure you're familiar with it, totally open to anyone. I did a search on cannabis clinical trials, and 738 peer-reviewed publications popped up, clinical trials involving cannabis. So it's not like the work isn't being done. It's not like the evidence isn't there, you know. For the DEA, just think about it. They're a dinosaur agency. Much of their budget depends on cannabis. That's probably 80% of their enforcement efforts are about cannabis. If they reschedule cannabis, their budget's going to evaporate. It's a matter of, or certainly be greatly reduced. So it's a matter of, for them, self-preservation. We have to keep this in a schedule so that, you know, our people will stay employed, basically. And this is not based, you know, this isn't based on any solid criteria. And people are no longer fooled. This is why, you know, I mean, the DEA needs to just go away. They need to slink away in shame, because, you know, if they are the cutting edge of the so-called war on drugs, you know, there could be no more dismal failure. You know, there's been more than a trillion dollars has been spent on the war on drugs since the 70s. And look where we are, more drugs than ever. But this is what institutions, bureaucracies do. They try and perpetuate themselves.
I read a fascinating article that was talking about a well-established organized crime. It's somewhere in Russia. I forget the exact location, but the roadways in this area were really deplorable, and they were so bad that these black marketeers were getting a lot of breakdowns and damage to the vehicles. And these guys put into their budget road maintenance, and they started repairing the roads so that they could shift their black market materials around more effectively. And I just can't find a more kind of hilarious example of, if you're reefed down on something that people want, and you create this prohibition black market kind of scene, you get all kinds of unintended consequences, and it inevitably doesn't deal with the problem itself. It shifts incentives into directions that you can't even dream of imagining. And it's just so fascinating to me that we still, like, a huge portion of in the United States in particular, there's this kind of puritanical element when we talk about substances that alter perception. And so long as it's, you know, if you go to your doctor to get some opiates, or you go to the 7-Eleven to get some booze, then it's okay because it's, quote, legal. But again, that legality piece just gets really slippery for me when I'm looking at it from a pharmacological, you know, toxicology type of perspective. I guess those times are changing a bit. You know, I guess with the information age and the internet and people being able to share information so much more
rapidly that it's more difficult to spin this stuff in a negative way, but it seems like the government has painted itself into a corner in a variety of ways on this topic.
Yeah, they definitely have. I mean, they, you know, in many ways they had it wrong from the beginning because the focus was on the substances, right? And it's like we have to ban these substances. But there's thousands of substances and more every day due to the proliferation of, medicinal chemistry and even in plants. So, you know, the focus had to be, should have been all along, education of people, you know, and the message should have been, we're immersed in a chemical ecology, if you will, of psychoactive substances. You need to know how to navigate. You need to know how to make informed choices about whether to use these substances and which ones and how to use them. It's really pretty simple. But the educational message has always been, just don't do it. Well, that's not helpful. That doesn't help people.
There's great literature demonstrating that it encourages exploration because anything that is prohibited makes you curious.
Right, exactly. So in the end, I mean, the DARE program, which was very ineffective, that's now recognized, had a lot to do, I think, with the fascination with drugs, with the now millennials or 20-somethings. They all had to take DARE. I have had any number of students who have told me the way I got interested in drugs was I took the DARE program in the sixth grade, and that made me curious. You know? So unintended consequences, right?
Dennis, this may sound crazy, but what would you think about this? You know, if we were to, and granted, this is like magic wand, fairy tale type stuff, but, you know, we deschedule this stuff, we find healthcare providers that can set up clinics, we continue clearly the fundamental research, but if somebody wants to do a psilocybin exploration or DMT or something like that, then they go to a clinical setting where they're screened and monitored and cared for. And then, whether the people are seeking this for spiritual reasons or health reasons, but there's actually a controlled, monitored, vetted system for these people being, moved through this experience, versus talking to Vinny down at the corner and getting some sort of white substance and and taking it at a rave where you're not safe and you know, it could be a harm to self or others. I mean, those are kind of the two options on the table in a way, right?
Yeah. And of course it totally makes sense, you know, with respect to psychedelics. If people want to have a psychedelic experience, there should exactly be what you describe, a center, which I would describe, it may be a clinic, but it'll look more like a spa. You know, it can be a comfortable place where you can come and have a spa weekend. And a part of that spa weekend might be taking a dose of psilocybin or ayahuasca and you could do it with your family. And I think it would do a lot for family dynamics, you know, first of all, I think, first, before that can happen, and talk about your magic wand solutions, basically all drugs should be legalized. That should be the starting point. And then legalize them and then regulate them. And, even the worst drugs, the most potentially abusable drugs like methamphetamine, just don't put the criminal stigma on it. Say, you know, okay, you really want to, you know, crank meth? Okay, you can crank meth. Here's your prescription. But you go to the drugstore to get your prescription, you have to get that from a healthcare provider. So create opportunities for people to have the conversation about their use of drugs and say, well, gee, there's all these other choices you can make. There are all these other much less harmful substances. You really want to crank meth? You know, and every time they go for their dose or whatever, they have to have that conversation. Eventually, you're going to get through to people. Oh, maybe there are better choices. I mean, my teeth are falling out. I'm weighed 90 pounds. All these bad side effects of something like meth, you'd think they'd wake up to it. So that's what we have to do. We have to create And other countries have shown, Lisbon, Portugal, Uruguay, yeah. They've legalized drugs across the board. And their society has not collapsed. You know, drug use has gone down overall. Nobody's too excited. You can have small amounts of drugs, and nobody's getting too excited. And, you know, that's what we need to do. You know, we need to do it. It's not, Rob, it's not that this is not about the substances. This is about controlling people's behavior, controlling people's consciousness, ultimately. This is a war on consciousness. And that's why it's dangerous, I think. You know, we say that we're a democracy in this country. We're really, in many ways, we're quite totalitarian. You know, we want to regulate behavior, individual behavior. You know, same issues apply to women's health and abortion and all these things. You know, the right says, well, we want small government. But when it comes to, you know, what you think or what your medical choices are or who you marry, we want micromanagement on those issues. And I think that's a, you know, that's fallout from this sort of authoritarian, you know, puritanical, Christian history that we come out of, where anything fun was automatically bad, right?
Right, right.
And so that's what you're seeing, you know. But they don't want to let individuals make their choices. The government is very paternalistic. We're children. We don't have the wisdom to make our own choices on these issues. So we'll make the choices for you. And if you don't like it, you can go to jail.
I could not agree more. The main fundraising type stuff I do is for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And these are the folks that go out and fight the feds when guys in body armor. And I love the police, military, and fire scene. I love the folks in that. But a lot of what gets implemented is absolutely appalling. But, you know, there's an Amish family that's selling raw milk and raw cheese. They don't pasteurize it. And this is the way it's been done for a couple of thousand years. And the feds show up, dump out their milk, haul away their cows, throw these Amish farmers in the clink. And the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund comes to their defense. But inevitably, what happens is somebody phones the local health department and files a complaint that there's something dangerous going out in that Amish farm. It's fascinating. And oftentimes it ends up linking back to some sort of a bigger food producer or something like, and this is where the conspiracy stuff gets kind of thick. But it's fascinating to me that we really do seem to have these kind of two main bodies, the kind of the left and the right. And usually we talk about health, but what the heck, we'll diverge into politics a smidge. But to your point, we have two large groups of people that want to be very paternalistic in what we tell people what they can and can't do. And we seem to have a very small kernel in the middle of people that are like, hey, I don't want to tell you what to do at all, and I would prefer you not tell me what to do, so long as, you know, what we're up to isn't causing injurious harm to one or the other or someone else. Let's just leave things be. And people are really fidgety and anxious about the prospect of not trying to control everyone and everything around them. Why is that? Is that a normal human state? Like, or is this an artifact, again, you know, kind of Judeo-Christian culture? Would China have developed more of a kind of libertarian approach to drugs had it not had heavy influence from the West, which, you know, wove this kind of psychology and morality along with market forces into steering the way that people acted? Like, would we get more innovation if the U.S. wasn't the largest, wealthiest country in the world?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in China, in countries like this, they're very authoritarian. Mm-hmm. And, I they're certainly happy to make any number of, illegal drugs and ship them to the States, or drugs that would be, you know, I'm not sure what's happening with drug policy in China, but my guess is it's probably frowned upon. if not really actively persecuted. Probably most people don't have access to the, you know, kinds of drugs that we have. They're much harder to get. But ultimately, it's authoritarianism. It's the, you know, the Chinese are quite out front compared to the States in that they want to control what people think.
Right.
And, you know, they restrict what people can read, what they can get off the internet, because, you know, and that's an authoritarian society. The States pays lip service to the fact that we have freedom of press and freedom of thought and all this, but it's really lip service in a lot of ways, you know? I mean, they have their own interest in authoritarian, you know, mechanisms, and they, you know, but they're more subtle somehow.
Right.
I mean, you know, right. Or they appear to be more subtle. What's good is that, you know, with so much information available, people see through this propaganda much more readily. Actually, psychedelics, again, are an antidote to the poison that culture dishes out, you know, the toxic crap that they call culture. Many younger people that I encounter, you know, are not fooled by the propaganda, and many of them credit psychedelics. It was, oh yes, I took psychedelics and then I saw what was going on. And so they're teaching tools in that respect. And, you know, granted, the authorities recognize this to a certain extent. Psychedelics are dangerous because they make you have dangerous ideas, right? And those threaten the power that be. And so, yeah, in some sense, they know they're dangerous. It's ideas they're worried about, not substances.
Dennis, how are they dangerous? Like, I think that some people, if they're kind of conservative leaning, they would say, well, they're dangerous because they make you crazy. Like, that's not what you're saying. What I take from that is they're dangerous because, you know, usually one of the commonalities of most of these psychedelics, the experience is a sense of unity, that you're a part of something larger, but also not, at the same time, it's kind of ego crushing because you usually get a sense that you're here for a brief moment and then you're gone. And, you know, so it really undermines a lot of the things that theoretically hold together a society like the United States. But then you have like the Scandinavian countries, which are quite low in religious following, and they are not sacrificing babies on altars and stuff like that. They actually tend to be pretty darn nice places to both live and visit.
Yeah.
What are the dangerous ideas? Like, just that you kind of see through some of the BS that's spun, and why does that happen? What's that mechanism?
Well, I think that psychedelics enable you to get a different perspective. What they let you do is step out of your reference frame temporarily and look at things from a different perspective. And if you're looking at, you know, governments, regulation, ideas, this sort of thing, you know, you can view it in a way that you never have. I mean, as you say, often psychedelics, you know, induce meaningful experiences about how we're all one and we're all part of something bigger. And essentially the kind of messages that religions like to promulgate, but they don't like it when people need to get that from the officially sanctioned religious institutions, right? It's like, You, the individual, you're not good enough to have a mystical experience, right?
Directly.
We, the priests, will tell you what to think, right? You can't go talking to God. You can't step out of the authoritarian structure. So they're dangerous in that sense. They're dangerous in the sense that they make you think about your role in the world. You know, you might take a psychedelic, step out of your reference frame and think, why should I work for a soulless corporation for the rest of my life in a cubicle, you know, where it's mind-numbing work, it's not helping the world, you know, so that at the end of the day, they can dump me out on the street and say, sorry, you don't get our pension, you know, because we had to cancel that last year. it makes you see the soullessness and the essential, in some ways, evil of these corporations, government institutions, and so on, which are not serving the well-being of people. They're serving the well-being of corporations and government institutions. They're self-perpetuating. So this is heresy. They make, I mean, psychedelics give you funny ideas, and funny ideas almost by definition are heresy. You know, they go against what is accepted belief. We need a lot more of that, in my opinion. You know, that's what happens when people, you know, think for themselves. You know, when people are growing up, when they're younger, in maybe they grow up in a religious household, and maybe to a certain stage in their development, they, you know, they accepted these teachings. But at a certain stage, you know, a lot of people, they're thoughtful and they're thinking, and maybe around 12, between 12 and 15, they begin questioning some of this stuff. It's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense, you know? And so they become, you know, they leave the faith or whatever. I'm all in favor of leaving the faith. I have no use for faith. Faith is being asked to believe something without any evidence. You know, I'm all, and why should you? I mean, we, at least we should ask for evidence for belief. But religion is not for that. It's like you must have faith. You must not ask a lot of bothersome questions. As a person who really believes that one should think for themselves, I question that. I think more people should question that. I think more people, you know, are questioning that. So the trend is overall positive, but it, we've got a long way to go.
Yeah, nobody's. I think we have good job security in pushing these ideas. No, nobody is going to come in and scoop it up and fix these problems right up from underneath us, and we'll be left wondering what we're going to do next year. So I'd
love to be out of a job if that's
what's exactly keeping, that. Exactly,
that's what's keeping me going. I'd love to say, oh. They don't. Nobody wants to listen to me. Everybody got the message.
Yeah, everybody has the message, and they understand it better than I do. So I'll go do something else. My dream is that on this healthcare side of things, that enough people get this story that I can go farm coconuts and do spearfishing and call it good. Do my little permaculture farm operation, and my services are not needed, but it still seems like it needs a little bit of a push. But I'm working towards the coconut farm. But Dennis, it's. Yeah. Dennis, it's been so fantastic having you on the show. Where can people find you on the internet, and where will you be speaking in the next couple of weeks or months?
Gosh, well, I have this three events in New York this weekend at a place called Alchemist Kitchen. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I've got quite a busy schedule. There's a conference in Prague, Czech Republic. I think it's from the 29th or something of September to the 2nd of October, called Beyond Psychedelics. I'll be speaking there. And I'm also going to, there's another conference in Rio Branco, Brazil, in October, the World Ayahuasca Conference, and I'll be going there. So that's where they can catch up with me. Most of this will be on my Facebook page. I have a Dennis McKenna public figure Facebook page. They can look at that. And also, I should not forget to plug my book.
Right, right.
Which is the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, My Life with Terrence McKenna. And there is a website by that name, and there's also a Facebook group by that name. So it's member only, but you can ask to join. Almost everything I'm up to will be posted on that page, and also my Dennis McKenna page. So that's how you can track me.
Fantastic. And we'll get all that in the show notes. Dennis, really a huge honor having you on the show. Would really like to meet you in real life at some point. Maybe we can get you out to Paleo FX next year and do a talk for the giant Paleo Nerd Fest in Austin. There's amazing food and some wonderful people there. So maybe we'll try to get you out for that.
I'm open to that. I'd love to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. We didn't even touch on all that. But there, you know, there's a whole other area of discussion there. So, yeah, it's been a real pleasure. All the best to you. You're doing great work. And, yeah, maybe I'll see you there next year.
I will make it happen. I know somebody who knows somebody in that organization, so I'll get the wheels going on that.
Sounds good.
Okay,
Sounds
Dennis, good. Take care and safe travels.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.